Groups like Friends of the Earth lost their fight to stop the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, but they did force the oil companies to build a better pipeline. A few decades later, the Exxon Valdez disaster spilled 11 million gallons of oil into Prince William Sound. In the aftermath of that disaster, Congress passed the Oil Spill Prevention Act. So how has the environmental movement helped transform the oil industry in Alaska? We're discussing the environmental legacy of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The environmental legacy of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline runs deep, and we have two experts to talk about that legacy today as part of our series and the podcast, Midnight Oil. To check out the series, including stories on how oil was discovered at Prudhoe Bay, you can go to our website, alaskapublic.org, or subscribe in whatever podcast app you use. We've got two environmental activists with us today. Rick Steiner is a marine conservation biologist and consultant. And Rick lived in Cordova when the Exxon Valdez ran aground. Hello.
Hi, Lori. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for being here. Art Davidson is a natural resource planner and a businessman. He worked for Friends of the Earth at the time of the pipeline hearings and is the author of In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez. Hi, hey, Art.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. You, Alaskans, can also join our conversation today, or if you're listening online, anywhere you can join our conversation today. Were you part of the fight for measures to ensure oil could be transported safely through Alaska? Do you think there's enough regulation, too much? Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. That's statewide. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Art, I want to start with you. Describe where you were in your life when you first heard about the idea to build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. What was going on?
Well, I was with my first wife and little children renting a house up O'Malley Road, and shortly after oil was discovered and they were going to build the road and develop it, an oil company bought the house and evicted me because they needed it for their people. That was probably my first awareness that, oh, we better figure out what's going on here. No, but I'll tell you, I was working for Friends of the Earth. I was the first kind of full-time conservationist in that sense in Alaska at the time. And when the pipeline hearings came up, now that the hearings were focused on getting a permit to build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline across the state. And I remember the day of the hearings, I was one of very, very few people who spoke in opposition of giving the permit. Now, the debate was over issues like doing this huge construction in the cold, the permafrost, the impact both of the pipeline and the access road on the wildlife. But even at that time, my main concern was the transport of the oil from Valdez on these huge tankers, because all this oil would be, you know, kind of vulnerable going over the ocean. But that was not a subject of the permit. Mm-hmm. So my objective and what we tried to do with Friends of the Earth was, you know, not to keep the oil forever in the ground, but to try to force the industry and the government, as best we could, to take the time to try to build a safer pipeline. And they'd never build a pipeline in this kind of climate in the Arctic and subarctic. And there was a great rush to get this to market. And so that's what we were trying to do, is to provide an opportunity to build a safer transport system.
And how big of an organization at that time was Friends of the Earth? Did they really think that the organization could stop what was coming as far as the pipeline?
Well, Friends of the Earth was not a huge organization. There was no big, huge national conservation lobby, so to speak. Mm-hmm. although there were people all over the country, and then some of them activists and organizations like the Woodland Society, Sierra Club, their local organizations who were concerned. But at the time, there was this new law, the Environmental Policy Act of 1969, and that had been enacted to say, let's take a careful look at what the different possible effects are of whatever we do on federal lands. And it required, among other things, an environmental impact statement. And within that statement, there you had to look at alternatives to the proposed action. Are there viable alternatives? Well, this act had just been passed, I think, the previous year. And so we felt that this was an appropriate test of the act. It was the first time it had really been contested, and we were going to see what is the real meaning of environmental impact statement. So that we filed suit for an injunction, saying, look, they have not followed the law. And the judge agreed with that. And virtually simultaneously, the Native community saying, look, you know, we have our Aboriginal rights to, you know, to land that was we use traditionally in Alaska. That's never been adjudicated. We need to resolve that before you just build this pipeline across Alaska. So those two sort of legal motions were put in effect. But we just felt that, look, let's follow the law. Now, this was an affront, felt as an affront to the many people in the oil industry because, you know, quite frankly, it's a very big and powerful industry, and they'd been building pipelines and developing oil all over the world and never been sort of challenged, if you will, by a law, this Environmental Policy Act. And so it, you know, that that kind of caught them by surprise.
Well, I want to back up just a little bit and get Rick in here, too. But first, I want to remind folks that you're listening to Talk of Alaska. Today's program is about NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and how all those two things converged. We are talking with Art Davidson, author and environmental activist, and Rick Steiner, who is a biologist and also an environmental activist. They're in the studio today to talk about the legacy of NEPA and the impacts on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. What protections, if any, were in place before NEPA, before the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act? What was in place?
Rick,
do you want to tackle that one? Was there much?
Well, that's more of a historical question, and unfortunately, not much. There was sort of a haphazard state and federal regulatory regime, and I think that's what precipitated the need for a national Environmental Policy Act. And actually, interestingly, one of the first comprehensive environmental impact statements ever done was here in Alaska. It was the Cape Thompson Project in northwestern Alaska, where the peaceful uses of atomic energy crowd wanted to excavate a new harbor at Cape Thompson using an atomic bomb. And they did a very, very comprehensive environmental impact statement of that. And then here NEPA is passed, and it became, you know, Arts Group and many others invoked it in the TAPS debate. And I also wanted to say that, you know, looking back at TAPS and the decision to route it across Alaska, I think it was the wrong decision, and I think a number of people in retrospect agree with that, and a number of my friends in Prince William Sound certainly agree with that. The Exxon Valdez oil spill was a quintessential, vivid example of why it should not have been built. Pipelines are a lot safer than tankers, period. The risk assessments show that. So the Prudhoe oil should have gone across to Canada and down the Mackenzie to the Canadian grid. It would have been a much safer decision. Alaska still would have had the revenue from the oil and Prudhoe, et cetera, and Prince William Sound still would have been a vibrant, pretty nice ecosystem right now, and it's been seriously degraded.
Was that considered by the companies?
Oh, absolutely.
And why did that fall apart? Why was it decided to go down through Alaska instead?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, as Rick says, yes, it was considered, but I would add in just to a certain extent. Right. It was a very interesting encounter I had, actually, at Wally Hickel's house. Nixon was coming back from China, and he had his cabinet members there. And in one of the side rooms, Rogers Morton, who was the Secretary of Interior at the time, was surrounded by a number of Alaskans, very involved in business, and our Congressman Howard Pollack was there as well. And I think it was Pollack who asked, he says, well, now, Mr. Secretary, you've got this injunction, and it says you're going to have to consider other routes, possibly an overland route through Canada. And I agree fully with Rick that an overland route and an all pipeline is you know, there'll be spills, there'll be accidents, but it's much safer than carrying oil over water. And so Rogers Morton was asked, well, are you really considering not sending this oil down through Alaska and the tanker? And he said, oh, no, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. We're going to put this down through Alaska, and it's going to go to Valdez. But don't let the judge know I said that. No, don't let Judge Hart know that, or we'd be in big, big trouble. Never suspecting that there was a young environmentalist-minded person at his elbow. So I would say that there was not a real serious consideration of an all-overland route. There were a lot of political, economic forces that people wanted to build it all the way through Alaska, not part of the way through Alaska and partly through Canada. And that carried the day.
And would there have been then other... In addition to negotiating with the Canadian government, then there probably would have been First Nations claims that the pipeline would have had to go through, just like the claims of Alaska Native people here about their lands and their rights. Isn't that true? I mean, that may have been part of what the holdup was or the reason that they did not want to go that route?
I think that's part of it. And certainly it would have taken a little bit longer to sort that out. But, you know, that oil had been in the ground for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, oil is a very, very valuable resource, and it's going to be more valuable even in the future probably than it is today. So I was of a mind that we need to take the time to do this right. There's too much at stake.
Let's go to the phones for just a moment and get somebody from Valdez on the line. Jerry, hello.
Yeah. I remember long ago the pipeline safety people said if there was a break in the pipeline anywhere, that all they'd have to do is shut down the upstream valve, the closest to the break, and keep pumping from the next pump station, and they could reduce the pressure in the line right away and create a vacuum, and basically the leak would be stopped. And this would only take a couple of hours. And then the pipeline was shot with a 338, up north of Fairbanks, and I think it took over 2 days to get the pressure off the line. And the two things I'm wondering is, did shutting down some of the pump stations along the line have anything to do with that? And shutting down pump station 12, that means pump station 11 has to pump that oil all the way from Glen Allen over Thompson Pass, which means it's probably going under increased pressure on a line that's well past its engineered life. So I'll get off the phone and listen to your response to this. Thanks.
Rick?
The only thing
Rick Snyder?
I'm certainly not a pipeline engineer, and
right.
That's a question specific for them. However,
it's an interesting question, though.
You're right. That was in 2001, right after 9/11, and a fellow shot a few shots into it. Alyeska, and it just exposed once again, Alyeska's response plan didn't work. It did take them 2 to 3 days to put a sleeve that they were supposed to have available and on any sort of rupture immediately, and closing the gate valves and such like that. But it took them way too long, and that gets back to the Exxon Valdez response, which was essentially an utter and catastrophic failure. So their risk assessments are pretty failed or faulty, as well as their response contingency plans are often look nice on paper, but to actually implement them is a different story.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about some of how NEPA was used, the National Environmental Policy Act. The attorney that worked with the Friends of the Earth, Jim Moorman, found that there were only 8 pages of an environmental impact statement based on NEPA for this 800-mile pipeline. So that's when Friends of the Earth sued. It seems like the detailed statement part of NEPA could have been fairly easily overlooked, because it sounds kind of like, okay, detailed statement, what does that mean? Were there other levers that also were in within NEPA that could have been used in addition to what turned out to be such an important part of it, the environmental impact statement portion of it?
Well, I think if you go back and look at the case, you'll find, you know, a full kind of array of arguments that touch on different aspects of NEPA. But I think that was the main thing, that you have to do a credible environmental impact statement. And they came back, and I think the statement they came back with was something like 9 volumes and 3,500 pages. So obviously there was a lot more that needed to be defined and discussed. But again, you know, the industry and some, you know, governmental people were of a mind to rationalize and justify what they really wanted to do. And circling back to what Rick said of things looking good on paper, one of the most, when I was writing the book in the wake of the Exxon Valdez, probably the most telling comment I got was from a Dr. Ian White, who was based in London, and he worked for the industry's Oil Pollution Board. And he said, the public, particularly in America, has been misled for years. There is no magic bullet. There is no realistic way to recapture oil once it's lost, particularly in tankers. And I think what we found, and the people like Rick and a lot of other people, I think Jerry who called in, I think is alert to these things, that we're told things by people who really want to justify what they're doing. And we found out again and again and again that their safeguards just didn't hold up. And, you know, to me, it doesn't mean that there aren't good people working in the oil industry. I've got friends. They're making their life that way. But you have to, long ago, I accepted the fact that big companies are going, they have a purpose to make money. Mm-hmm. They want to do it the quickest, most efficient way they can. And many of them don't have that much of a social conscience. Some have more than others. But that's why I feel it's really critical for all of us to have some regulations that force industry to be responsible, to show that they can do what they say they can do if there's a break in a pipeline or a tanker hits a rock.
Before NEPA, before the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, how much pressure could be applied if a company, because it's not, in today's setting, it's certainly not in a company's best interest to do something haphazardly, because they're ultimately going to get dinged for fines and all kinds of other legal levers that can be used now. What was in place then so that, as you were saying, Art, their corporation's mission is to make money for their shareholders. There's nothing wrong with that, but was there a time when none of these other considerations even had to be part of the business plan, that environmental impacts were not at all considered?
I think that's the way the climate, the environment that the oil industry operated in all over the world. It was just a given to them that they could go in and build a pipeline because there'd be economic benefits. And there are very real economic benefits, but they were not being held accountable. And so my memory of those days is that before the Environmental Policy Act, there was very, very little that could cause a company to have to do the kind of thorough research and fully justify what they were doing.
So was it more than the work of people like organizations such as Friends of the Earth that would have to come forward and apply pressure on local governments and the federal government to try to force some sort of action?
Rick, go ahead.
Well, yeah.
I would say yes, but go ahead.
Absolutely, without question. And, you know, all this has evolved over the last 40 years. Certainly the citizen consciousness about environmental issues, corporate responsibility. But generally, the oil companies are very good at getting government to do what they want what they want government to do. And that hasn't changed. They've gotten better at it, actually, over the years. It's interesting that, actually, they prevailed in the lawsuit, and the fishermen of Prince William Sound joined that as well. And then it was, of course, they went to Congress, and the TAPS Act was passed. Mm-hmm. Spiro Agnew broke the tie, and the rest is history, with a few promises made that were very promptly broken. One, a state-of-the-art vessel traffic system in Valdez would be put in, double-hull tankers, the best oil spill response system in the world, not one drop of oil will go into Prince William Sound. All those three promises quickly went away after the TAPS Act was passed. Mm. So we lost faith in trusting government and industry at that time.
We are talking today on Talk of Alaska about the environmental legacy of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System as part of our series called Midnight Oil, and a deep examination of the 40-year history of oil development in Alaska. This is one piece of it. We're doing three Talk of Alaskas. We did one last month, we're doing one this month, and another next month that are all geared toward this special series of stories called Midnight Oil. You can check out more of that on our website, alaskapublic.org. We're talking today with Art Davidson and Rick Steiner. We're going to go back to the phones for a moment. Don is in Anchorage. Hi, Don.
Hi, Lori. Promises and practices. Big difference sometimes between them.
Here, here.
I've been up here since 68. Mm. I was working for Alaska Pipeline Service Company in the vaults in 1976 when they called for examination of the X-ray films, and they were questioning the strength and of the welds and the credibility of the pipeline coming down from Valdez. And we were in there. Basically, they had crews in there 24/7, trying to jam everything in there and get the thing finished up and the review done. And I can tell you firsthand, repeatedly, we came across film strips and stuff and items that were not signed, not accounted for verification. We also came across stuff where you look at the film strip, and you know it's awfully queer when a weld is so identical to another weld that you just looked at. I mean, you're looking at this stuff, you know, with a jeweler's loop, and you're scrutinizing the darn thing, and you hold them up to the light. You know, you got this little board in front of you with fluorescent light behind it, and you're looking at this darn thing, and you take another one, you put it right alongside of it. And then you take one, put it over top of the other, and the two are identical.
So what did that tell you, Don?
That tells you something stinks.
Indeed.
Don, I really appreciate you calling in. And it's good to hear from somebody who was out there working on the pipeline, who saw these things. And thanks for speaking up.
We had an email question. Thanks so much for the call, Don. It's good to hear from folks out there in Alaska. You can call us if you'd like to join the conversation as well. If you were part of the construction of the pipeline, if you think that the legacy of environmental law and regulation, do you think it's enough? Is it too much? What are your thoughts about the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the environmental legacy that is kind of as a result of this fight over where to put the line? 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org, as Jim Stratton did. He says, or he asks, after the court cases were finished and the pipeline was being constructed, did anyone in industry ever say anything to you, Rick or Art, that the process actually did improve the way it was constructed and improve the safety. Did you hear that from folks?
You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I did. I remember this one time at some meeting, a man came up to me I didn't recognize, and he says, "You drove me crazy. You have no idea how much you frustrated. Here you were, this young guy, and you were telling us, well, have you thought of this? And how do you know that's going to work correctly?" In other words, being a devil's advocate and saying, you know, how do you know this is going to work? This hasn't been done before. Have you? It drove us crazy. But I'll tell you something. Now we have, I appreciate it. You know, we have a safer pipeline because of that. And so that was very heartening. And I think there are probably many people. Rick, you probably had that experience too.
Certainly. And I think that's a lesson we need to carry forward, that critical analysis and people standing up and asking questions about these mega projects with potential environmental consequence is exactly what we need to be doing as engaged, informed citizens.
All right. We're going to go back to the phones once more before we have to take a short break. Jim is in Fairbanks. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Good morning, Rick. Good morning, Art.
Good morning, Jim.
You, of course, recall I followed you working for Friends of the Earth for David Brower.
This is Jim Kowalski.
That's yes. Right.
And, how many years has it been? And I do remember, I tell me if I'm wrong, I think it was ARCO, was it Edward Anderson, praised the lawsuit, actually, when he admitted that the initial effort was not satisfactory at all. And do I have that right?
I think so, Jim. I think Anderson was one of the most responsible oilmen that I ever encountered or dealt with. He wanted to do things right. He was like Dr. Ian White, in the sense that Ian White was saying, look, it's a trade-off. If you want the benefits of oil, you have to accept some risk. But let's be open and honest about what those risks are, and let's try to do it as safely as possible. So I think Anderson was Robert O. Anderson, wasn't it? Robert O. Anderson?
Yeah, I think so.
And so, you know, again, there are good people in industry, and there are good people in government trying to deal with these things. But the industry has such enormous power through lobbyists, affecting government, and ways to bring pressure on individuals. And I don't know if Rick wants to talk about it, but I believe in his own life, he's received a lot of pressure for speaking out about oil, for speaking the truth about some of the things that are happening.
Mr. Yeah, Steiner, you're on the hot seat now.
You might comment on this. It seems to me the oil pipeline in particular, that is its pending construction, had a great deal to do with what happened with the Alaska Native Claims. And then the following that was the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. They're all linked together. Could you just quickly comment on that?
Well, I think, you know, coming in here this morning and talking about the legacy, environmental legacy of the pipeline, that's one of the things I wanted to mention. And Jim, thanks for bringing that up. You know, because the pipeline is being built across Alaska, we had to settle. There was great force to settle in Alaska Native claims, and that's benefited a lot of Alaska Native people in many ways across the state, and all of the state, I would argue. And from that, when that was being settled in Congress, you know, our friend David Brower and other environmentalists and ourselves said, well, look, while we're doing this massive land allotment in Alaska, state lands, native lands, identifying which, this is the time to identify our future national parks, national refuges, wild and scenic rivers, and so forth. And so, as I recall, through all the studies and the final legislation, the national park system and refuge system was more than doubled in size. And that is part of the environmental legacy of discovering oil and the pipeline, and I think it has to be considered a benefit. So thanks for bringing that up, Jim.
I'd just like to add there that I firmly believe that both ANCSA and ANILCA would have been done irrespective of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, because they both had to be done in order to give the Native people, return to the Native people the lands that had originally been them, and resolve claims that way. Plus, our extraordinary national interest conservation lands would have been designated monuments and parks and refuges regardless. And we might have even gotten a better deal than Anilco, to be honest with you. So, but also there's a very profound, vivid downside to oil, to the Trans-Alaska pipeline. That's Exxon Valdez.
I agree with you, Rick, and put an exclamation point on we could have come up with a better land claim settlement if there had been more time. And I think many, many Native leaders feel that as well.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the environmental legacy of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And this edition of Talk of Alaska is part of our series called Midnight Oil. We're taking a deep look at the history of oil development in Alaska throughout the summer as part of the 40-year anniversary of the discovery at Prudhoe Bay. Next month, we'll be looking on Talk of Alaska at the future of what oil and resource development will look like in Alaska. And right now, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more calls and questions as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the history of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and especially as it relates to environmental law and the National Environmental Policy Act and other laws that were put in place at that time. My guests today, I should mention again, are Art Davidson, author and environmental activist, and Rick Steiner, who is a biologist and also a consultant and has dealt with oil issues for many, many decades. The NEPA challenge, the National Environmental Policy Act challenge to the pipeline, ultimately failed when Congress passed a law that put an end to court challenges. How big of a disappointment was that, or were things advancing anyway? Rick?
Well, in hindsight, it was a big disappointment. I mean, as we discussed earlier, several of us feel that the pipeline should never have been routed across Alaska. Tankers are much more risky than our pipelines. And so it was sort of baked in the cake that we'd have a devastating oil spill at some point in the early history of the pipeline, which is what the fishermen of Prince William Sound and the national environmental community most worried about. And it was somewhat inevitable given the complacency of the oil industry and, I would say, the government oversight. So, there was a lot of concern with the decision. And I too, had the opportunity to confront Roger C.B. Morton about the issue, and I asked him, what about the Canadian route? And I recall vividly that he said it was just too expensive. So that was part of the calculus. I know the maritime industry was lobbying for the Trans-Alaska route so they could have business for their ships and shipbuilders. There were a lot of political interests, but we've got to be better about making these policy decisions.
Well, and I do want to talk more in depth about the actual Exxon Valdez spill in a moment. But we have a caller on the line right now, Doug from Wasilla, who has a comment about the Canadian route idea. Doug?
Yeah, enjoy the show. I was just going to say, I don't think the Alaska-Canada route for the oil was ever really given serious consideration. Certainly from our politicians, I mean, they have to worry about Alaska jobs and providing. They're concerned, obviously, for the economy of Alaska. So I don't think they ever really considered the Canada route.
Doug, I think both Rick and I would agree with you completely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Doug. Let's talk about the Exxon Valdez. Rick, describe where you were when the spill happened.
Well, I was in Cordova, ready to fly out that morning for a fry day with Fish and Game to do some stream excavations to look at the salmon fry survival over the winter. But several years prior, and this is an important piece of the history, several years prior to Exxon Valdez, we had determined that there was a lack of vigilance at the terminal and the tanker system. And we took a model from Sullivan, Scotland, and requested that the Alaska pipeline owner establish a Citizens Oversight Council. This was 3 years prior to Exxon Valdez, because we saw that there were holes in the system. And I still to this day feel that if we had done that, we would have seen the holes in the system, we would have fixed them, and we never would have had the Exxon Valdez. Hindsight is 20/20. The industry and the government at the time were too stubborn. Fortunately, Senator Mike Szymanski, our senator for the Prince William Sound, state senator at the time, liked the idea, and he actually developed legislation to introduce to at least explore the notion, but that got killed by the oil industry. So in hindsight, if we had established a legitimate Citizens Advisory Council, I think we would have prevented this thing. But hindsight's 20/20. And right after the spill, of course, the oil, it was obvious it was uncontainable. It was inevitable that this would happen. Even if they'd had the best spill response capability in the world, they would not have gotten more than 10 or 15% of it back. As it was, they may have gotten 5% recovered. The damage was done. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. The damage ecologically, economically, and socially was absolutely off the charts and still continues to this day. And we can chat about that in a minute if you want.
And so when the spill happened, did it take a while to really understand the magnitude of what had happened and what it would mean in the long term? How long did it take you to sort of wrap your minds around what was going to be coming?
Boy, did it ever, because, you know, for the first couple of days, the oil was more or less in the area. And then as I was writing the book, it just kept going week after week after week. The oil escaped Prince William Sound, of course. It went down the coast. It affected one community after another. And as citizens and people hired by the industry went out to try to mop the oil up, it became more and more apparent how many animals, how many seals, how many eagles, how many seabirds, otters were being killed, and how many beaches and how much of Alaska was being impacted. And then you get to a whole other level that I think you've worked on, Rick, is what are the residual effects? That oil, there's a lot of oil out there in the beaches, and it's probably having some environmental effects to this day and probably on into the future. Those are the kind of things you study, I think.
Wasn't it Congressman Young that suggested it should be burned when the spill happened?
Several folks suggested that, and they actually tried that. They tried some ignitions, but the problem is you have to have fire boom to do that, to contain it. And they were worried about the potential ignition of all of the what was left on the tanker. And so that didn't work. They tried dispersants. Those didn't work. They tried mechanical containment and recovery, and that didn't work. And about 3 days into the spill, and I was in Valdez with the emergency command team at the time, a big storm blew up and blew the oil all over heck and gone, and there was absolutely no containment possible after that. Right. And the best that could be done was defensive booming of some of the salmon streams and hatcheries and critical wildlife habitat. And that was modestly successful, but to the largest extent, the response was an utter failure. And that gets back to Art's point that it's been a mythological narrative spun by government and oil with an agenda in mind that there is such a thing as effective open water response to a major marine oil spill, and there simply isn't, and there never has been.
Absolutely. And I'll add to that. I was talking with Frank Rossi, the head of Exxon Shipping, and he said there was a moment in those first couple of days when we seriously considered burning it. He says, we had no idea how big of a fire we'd start. It might burn southeast Alaska.
Yeah.
I mean, just a swath on the map.
Right.
And again, you know, there just were not safeguards, there were not ways to pick this up. And this is not just ancient history that we're talking about, because when you talk about going into the Arctic in the Arctic Ocean,
right.
and offshore anywhere in this world with pipelines and tankers, you're running the same risks, and you're going to run into the same kind of industry talk that it's safe. We know how to do it now. We've learned from the past. And it's there simply are no safeguards that are reliable, oil and water.
We're talking about the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the history, the environmental regulation history that was in many ways kind of spurred by this massive infrastructure project. And this is Talk of Alaska. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255 statewide, or in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go back to the phones. William is in Wasilla. Hi, William.
Good morning. I worked at the terminal during the construction era, and they had sediment ponds where the runoff from the mountainside would collect in there before it was allowed to run into the bay, so to make sure there was no oil getting out in there from any kind of spills that might occur. Well, one day there was a big scene out there in front of the terminal area, so they stopped all the construction, and everybody got involved in this to find out what was going on. And then someone realized, they did a study, found out that the shale that they were breaking loose to build the terminal was releasing the oil sheen that was coming through those sediment ponds and then going out into the harbor. So, okay, so everybody relaxed and went back to work. It was a natural occurrence. And that's one of the aspects of Alaska Native clay, if anybody's familiar with that, that makes it function the way it does when you make ceramics out of it, is it has oil in it.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that story. Very interesting, yeah.
All right.
And Lori, if I could offer, you were talking about regulations and laws regarding the pipeline and such. It's interesting and it's instructive to realize that the great regulations and laws that we needed were not put in place until after the disaster. So after
Open 90.
Yeah, Open 90, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, which established a better, more rigorous liability structure, required a phase-in of double-hull tankers, better watch standards, a more legitimate vessel traffic system. The industry responded with SERVs, the Ship Escort Response Vessel System, which was a remarkably successful system. We put the Prince William Sound RCAC, Regional Citizens Advisory Council, in place. A number of things were passed after the disaster.
Yes.
And so that's the lesson to us is, why wait? Mm. What we haven't done is take these lessons from Prince William Sound and apply them adequately in the Aleutians, where we have 20 times the ship traffic that we have in Prince William Sound right now, or the Arctic, where we have a very high risk of a heavy fuel oil spill and such. So we need to expand, apply the lessons we've learned the hard way from Prince William Sound elsewhere.
Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Jim is in Ketchikan. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, I want to first of all thank you all. This program has been just amazing. I just wish everybody in Alaska could turn their attention to this right now. But my thing is yes, you guys are talking about the safety aspects of it. Coming from experience up there as myself as well, I got to say that, the advisory committee and with the state and the feds involved, that you really have a good system intact right now, and I think that the possibilities of something like a disaster with the Exxon Valdez, that's really come probably down the road. I don't know if it's possible to happen again. It could happen. Mm-hmm. Never say never, but everything right now is really glued tight together there. It's a good working system. But, oil's king. No matter what you do, oil's king. We talk about renewable resources, what we can do for the energy of the people of the state of Alaska, whether the United States as well. They're talking about natural gas. Well, they're saying that's much safer than, oil tankers. Well, it is to a certain aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens aboard a ship. And the terminals, transportation. Transportation, number one, is always a key situation in something like this, because there's so many safety factors you do have to put into place. And as long as there's humans involved in it, you're going to have to weigh the difference out of how much safety do you need, how much oversight is there, and how fast can we respond to something if something was to happen again. But I really think this program you guys are putting out there this morning, the message is really clear and well put together. I want to thank you guys again and continue listening.
Well, thank you, Jim. And I, Art, before you go to that, I just want to kind of piggyback off what Jim said with an email question that we have from Tom in Fairbanks, who says, what if it had been built as originally some proposed? He says, if built as proposed through Canada, would it have been an environmental disaster that he claims some Russian pipelines on permafrost have been? Could that have been also a great risk?
If we had built, if instead of the tanker delivery system had been an all-overland pipeline, we would simply not have had the Exxon Valdez,
period,
which was a horrible, horrible environmental disaster. I'd like to go back to just a moment to what I think it was Jim in Southeast said about the human factor. When I was writing in the wake of the Exxon Valdez, what I was trying to do is dig as deeply as I could to why did this happen? What are the lines of responsibility? And I found out, you find, first of all, that the Exxon Valdez, as the tanker itself, was a good tanker.
Brand new.
The crew was a good crew. They made some mistakes. But what I found, one of the real reasons underlying that disaster was complacency. Mm. For example, there was some equipment in the Coast Guard office that was put in Valdez just to monitor and watch the tankers coming in and out that could track the tankers better. And it had malfunctioned. The replacement parts had been sitting there for 6 months, but had not put in. When I sat through a week or more of National Transportation Safety Board hearings and all the details of it, this one person from that control center, the Coast Guard, described how they tracked the tankers. He says, well, you know, we didn't have the electronic equipment up, so we had these little rubber duckies. And when one tank would arrive at the outer edges of Prince William Sound, we'd set a ducky up for it. And then as it called in, we would move that ducky around the room with the other duckies as they came in and out. And, of course, at midnight, somebody else came in this is hard to believe, but I'm telling you, I was right-handed and he was left-handed, so he had to reroute the duckies the other direction. In other words, you know, there had not been a spill. There had not been a disaster. And so people got used to just not updating the equipment, not being alert. Mm. You know, a person I like personally, but is our commissioner, environmental commissioner here in Alaska, Denny Kelso. Well, he had that wonderful line that the contingency plan of the industry, of Alyeska's contingency plan, in other words, what would they do if there was a big spill, was the greatest work of fiction since Moby Dick. However, when he became commissioner, he signed off on it without reading it. You know, there was just this sense, well, it's been working. We've been having the benefits. Nothing's gone wrong. And so I think that's complacency, and that's that human factor you spoke of.
And Jim mentioned.
Jim mentioned, that's right.
Concern over human error.
Yes.
And to piggyback on that, our pre-Exxon Valdez, the prediction for a spill of that magnitude in Prince William Sound was about once in every 215 years. Right? It happened in 12 years. Mm. And that points to our inability or our dishonesty in doing actual risk assessment. Any complex system like tankers or space shuttles or nuclear plants have this human-machine interface. People can make mistakes. Machines can break and fail. And when you have a sequence of them, you can have a catastrophic disaster. And that's what we had in Prince William Sound. We could have the same thing in the Arctic, the same thing in the Aleutians with shipping out there tonight. So we need to be better about doing that and making policy choices more conscientiously and precautiously.
We are going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue the discussion about the National Environmental Policy Act, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the environmental legacy in the 40-year history of the discovery of oil at Prudhoe Bay as part of our series called Midnight Oil that we're undertaking this summer as a look at that 40-year legacy as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old, interested in completing their education or starting a career, and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs, from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the environmental legacy that came about after the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and OPA 90, the Oil Spill Prevention Act of 1990. And when that act was passed, Rick, you talked a little bit about some of the changes that that law brought about, but give us a little bit of a rundown about what some of those regulations require.
OPA 90 was basically largely a liability improvement, making, you know, if there's one thing that motivates responsible corporate behavior, it is sufficient financial liability on the line. It didn't go far enough and should, but for instance, BP and the Deepwater Horizon paid over a total of like $50 billion. So that's sufficient liability to make a company do the right thing, you would think. But OPA 90 required double hull tankers to be phased in, which was a promise pre-pipeline, which was broken. It improved the vessel traffic system and expanded pilotage out to Bligh Reef there in Prince William Sound. It required the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council to be established, and a number of other things that we know are mitigation. And, you know, one of the callers said, you know, we can't get the risk to zero. We can't, but we can get it down as far as we can. The other thing is the long-term environmental impacts of Exxon Valdez are still with us today. A quarter of a century after the event, the government science basically concluded that many of the monitored injured resources and services had recovered. Some have not. And four are not recovering at all a quarter of a century later. And that includes Herring in Prince William Sound, Pacific Guillemots, marbled murrelets, and the AT1 killer whale pod that is now expected, which we saw surfacing in the oil in 1989, lost most of its members within the next 2 years. There are no reproductive females in the pod, and the pod is expected to go extinct. So the lesson here is not only can these massive oil spills have acute, severe environmental impact, but they can have long-term and even permanent environmental damage. So we need to be more honest about that in our calculation.
Let's take one more call, and then, Art, I'll get some comments from you, and then I want to talk about the future also. Stuart is in Homer. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, good morning. I guess my question actually kind of follows up on just the last dialogue there. I'm aware of a number of times that in a prosecution situation, the oil industry finds that it's cheaper to just pay the fine and go on about doing their business as is, as opposed to doing repairs or upgrades or, you know, making it 110% safe. It's just we've allowed this combination between the government and the industry to just kind of slap them on the wrist and go, you know, bad, bad, bad. From what I understand, in Norway, the penalties for messing up are extremely severe against the oil industries, and therefore, they're not messing up. They're not, as far as I understand, I think they've got probably an almost 100% track record of not spilling stuff. And I think we really need to find some stronger penalties or fines or something, you know, make it serious.
Okay, let's thank you, Stuart, for that, putting that out there. Rick, you travel a lot internationally consulting on oil projects and with governments and industry. What about Norway?
I've been to North Norway and on the Barents Sea between there and Svalbard, and the Norwegian government has done a pretty good job, but they are also an owner of Statoil, of their oil, major oil industry, so it's a different calculus there. But regardless, I think Stuart's comment is spot on. We need to improve the liability that oil industry and all companies face if they do commit gross negligence, which in the Exxon Valdez case was proven in the Alaska courts. And if you commit gross negligence, there is no limitation to liability. But if it's simple negligence, there are some pretty severe limitations. Those need to be expanded or removed, I think so. I think, Stuart, you're spot on there.
And Art, we only have a couple of minutes left. Did you want to follow up? There was a question about bonding requirements for large projects, a question from a listener named John, wondering if those bonding requirements are adequate or if they should be changed.
Well, you know, I think bonding requirements are always a good measure. But I think there's a much larger picture that concerns me. You know, I've thought about the Exxon Valdez spill as a teachable moment. And there was much to learn from it. But as I look back, I remember, I feel like the whole debate about how to safely bring that oil to market across Alaska or all overland route, I feel like the same kind of situation is repeating itself because we're looking at climate change, at global warming, and that's a direct, has a huge correlation with our use of oil. And, you know, we have naysayers now. In the White House, in Congress, across the country, who say, oh, these scientists don't really know what they're talking about. And I think the key here is, as a species, as humans, as a society, can we really truly be proactive? And can we take these consequences that we see out there on the horizon, the threats, take them seriously and do the safeguards and measures that can be done? And I'd like to think that the experience of oil and development in Alaska and the work that people like Rick have done, taking that message and that expertise around the world is going to help. But we have to take that seriously.
And by being proactive, are there times when, as some in Congress have said, that it goes too far, that there's too much regulatory burden, that there's too much federal overreach, that it takes too much? And I'm sorry, I only have a few seconds here, Rick, to give us...
I'm sure that happens, but, you know, Art's point is spot on. We need to use these as teachable moments, Exxon Valdez, Deepwater Horizon, whatever, to look at energy policy, sustainable, low-carbon, clean energy transition that we need to be moving towards. And unfortunately, you have this religion that oil has become in Alaska, and it's heretical for those of us to suggest that we think about this in a different way. Climate change is real. The other costs of oil are real. We need to get serious about it.
Well, thank you so much to my guests, Art Davidson and Rick Steiner. This has been Talk of Alaska, and a special edition as part of our series looking at the 40-year history of oil discovery in Alaska, the series called Midnight Oil. You can find more on our website, alaskapublic.org.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on July 25th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Bernard Memorial Sports Center in Wasilla. The event is open to all. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.